She was in London with my father and they started to get bombed. Now, she could have gone back to America and sat out the war, but she had this sense of justice and she realized what was happening in Europe was absolutely horrible. And in 1942, she gets the chance of becoming a war correspondent.
Willkommen in Folge 96 von Die Sucht zu sehen, dem Griesebach-Podcast. Alle zwei Wochen sprechen wir hier mit Menschen, die etwas in der Kunst oder über sie zu sagen haben. Heute zu Gast ist Anthony Penrose. Der Brite ist Autor eines Buches, das mit Kate Winslet verfilmt wurde. Gerade ist der Film in den deutschen Kinos angelaufen. Er heißt Die Fotografin und er handelt von Anthonys Mutter. Sie hieß Lee Miller, war wunderschön, glamourös, sehr mutig und schrieb mit ihren Fotos Geschichte. Wir freuen uns sehr, dass ihr Sohn heute hier ist, um uns von ihr zu erzählen. Herzlich willkommen bei Die Sucht zu sehen, lieber Anthony Penrose. Anthony, we're here because your mother's life has been made into a film based on a book you wrote. The movie is called Die Fotografin. It's starring Kate Winslet and it has just started in cinemas around Germany. And as I can reveal, it is absolutely fascinating. Is it fair to say that your mother's life has been so unusual, it's hard to believe one person lived it all?
It is true to say that, and I titled my book The Lives of Lee Miller because she had so many different lives, different careers, all of which she was very successful in. And it seems like there were lots of different people, but actually it was just her.
Please, Anthony, introduce us to her. When did she live and what made her famous?
Lee Miller was born in 1907 in Poughkeepsie, that's in upstate New York. Her parents were just a modest family. Her dad was an engineer, her mother was a nurse. And she began to become interested in photography because her dad was an amateur photographer. And so a little bit later, when by complete accident she became a fashion model for Vogue, she regarded each photography session by people like Edward Steichen as a kind of tutorial, and she learned everything she could. And then she decided she'd had enough of being a model. I would rather make a picture than be one. So she went to Paris and met Man Ray, and they became lovers and fellow artists, and she became a surrealist. And then she went to New York and had her own studio, which was very successful. But suddenly, without a question of doubt, she married, out of the blue, an Egyptian and lived the next 5 or 7 years in Egypt. In 1937, she came to Paris, met my father, Roland Penrose, and they fell in love. And he kind of pursued her for the next couple of years.
I want to jump back to how her career started back in New York. She went to New York when she was 19 years old.
Yes.
She was discovered on the street by the man who published Vogue magazine.
Well, that was right. She was walking through New York and she stepped out in front of an oncoming truck and she would have been killed had it not been this guy grabbed her and pulled her back.
And he was the one, he happened to be the one, the publisher of Vogue magazine, Condé Nast.
And Vanity Fair as well. So without much ado, she found herself being a model.
In fact, she became one of the most prominent faces of the magazine at that time. Did she like her job as a model?
Not really. She said later, I would rather make a picture than be one. And she had learned so much from hanging around with Steichen and other Vogue photographers that she now knew a bit, and she went to Paris because she was interested in the work of Man Ray, the most exciting avant-garde photographer of that time.
I assume by that time there weren't many female fashion photographers around. What made her images so special?
I think what made her work special was the surrealist quality. Because even though we see what seems to be a formal fashion photograph, there's often something a little bit quirky about it that makes it distinctive. And she was very good at slipping those little twists and quirks into the work. And she did that right through to the very end of her life. It was something that never left her, that surrealist eye.
Did she learn that from Man Ray?
I think she actually had it before she met Man Ray, but what he did was validate it and encourage her to build on it.
In Paris, where she moved 1929, as you already explained, she became the assistant of Man Ray, and both of them hung out with friends like Picasso. He painted her quite a few times, didn't he?
Yes, that was in 1937, and he painted her six times.
Wow.
A la Arlésienne, like a woman from Arles. And then over the ensuing years, Lee photographed him more than 1,000 times. So it was, I think, a fair exchange of portraiture.
In the 30s as well, your mother has become an established photographer for Vogue. This was when she met your father, right?
Yes, she met my father at a crazy fancy dress ball in Paris in 1937 in June, and her Egyptian husband Aziz had given her a ticket to Paris, and the night she arrived she met my father,
and that was that.
they were in love from that moment on. It was love at first sight.
Who is he?
He's called Roland Penrose. He was a British surrealist artist who lived most of his adult life in Paris and France in general. And he was close friends with people like Man Ray and Max Ernst and Miro and Paul Éluard and others. So he was like already in the same circle as Lee, but the extraordinary thing is they did not meet until that time.
Did you call your mother Lee, by the way? Did you call her by her first name, or is it how you call her now?
I tended to avoid trying to call her anything because I had such a conflicted relationship with her.
Okay.
But I used to call her mummy or mother.
Okay.
And that was difficult because I didn't feel that she was somehow.
Yeah. Your parents met shortly before World War II broke out. How did your mother then decide to become a war correspondent?
She was in London with my father and they started to get bombed. Now, she could have gone back to America and sat out the war, but first of all, she didn't want to leave my father. She was in love with him. But more importantly, she had this sense of justice, and she realized what was happening in Europe was absolutely horrible, and all of her French friends in particular were going to be in grave danger because they were all left-wing surrealist artists and others. And she didn't want to desert them, so she stayed in England. And to begin with, she could not become a war correspondent of any kind because the British wouldn't have women as correspondents. But eventually America joins the war, and in 1942 she gets the chance of becoming a war correspondent. And that's really important to her because now she can report on the war. What she wants to do is to tell America what's happening here in Europe and to make sure that they have an interest in coming and helping us, because otherwise we're going to be overrun as well in Britain.
Her war images have been called brave and uncompromising. She documented women in combat as well as later the liberation of the concentration camp Dachau. On the day Adolf Hitler committed suicide in Berlin, she went to his apartment in Munich, undressed and sat down in his bathtub. What can you tell us about the world-famous photography that emerged from that?
I can tell you what I know from David Sherman, who was there. And he said to me...
He was a war correspondent as well, working for Life magazine, right?
That's right. David Sherman was a Life magazine photojournalist, a person of great distinction, and Lee's wartime buddy. And he told me, he said, "We had not had our clothes off for 3 weeks. We stank worse than a bunch of polecats. And here was hot water and soap and towels, and we could not resist it." And so then they realized they had a scoop. So they set the shot up. You'll notice that on the left-hand side, on the edge of the tub, there is a photograph by Hitler's revolting pet photographer called Heinrich Hoffmann. And that photograph was a poster that was all over the place, and it said, "Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer, Großdeutschland." And I don't know about you, but when I hear people saying, "Make America great again," or whatever, it really makes my blood run cold.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, she put that on the side of the tub, really to assert where they were and like they had control over the place. And then look at the boots on the bath mat, because that morning those boots had carried her around Dachau, and now she's stamping the filth of that place into that nice, clean bath mat in this very private space. And the metaphor for that is like she's grinding her heel into Hitler's face, because she's not a guest. She's a victor, and she knows it.
Your mother understandably was traumatized by the war and stopped taking pictures soon after. Your parents moved to a farm in Sussex, where you were born and grew up. The farmhouse became quite an artistic center in the post-war years. What was it like to grow up there?
It was a wonderful place to grow up. Most of the time I was completely alone there with my nanny, who was called Patsy. It was she who really brought me up, because my parents were usually someplace else. And
where did they go?
Oh, they were in London, or they were in Paris, or they might have even been in America, because they were very connected to the world of art. And
meeting up with artists.
Yes, they were hanging out with other artists, or they were arranging exhibitions or whatever that was going on at the time. And so I was on my own with Patsy and our great big yellow dog called Heather. And the people on the farm became a kind of extended family to me. And I was very happy. And then at the weekends, suddenly cars would begin to arrive and all these people would tip out and come into the house. And some of them were foreign. They spoke in strange languages, and some I liked better than others, but it was great. And they would just hang around for the weekend and have a great time. There'd be a lot of laughter and a lot of boozing, which didn't interest me at all, of course, as a child. And then they'd go away again and just leave Patsy and I to our lovely quiet place.
Your mother loved to cook for them all.
She did, and this was very significant. She became a kind of gourmet celebrity chef with a tremendous influence of surrealism in her work. And this is what saved her, because in the post-war years, she suffered dreadfully from post-traumatic stress disorder. And she got over this by reinventing herself as this celebrity chef. And it was spectacular, because we had all these weird dishes like, you know, blue spaghetti and green chicken and pink cauliflower breasts and gold meatloaf and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I had to say, I would sit there and dream of poached egg and baked beans on toast, but it was an exciting time. And it saved her life, because she just found this new passion, this new focus, and it was something that she could always experiment with and use her scientific brain a bit on. And it was brilliant.
There is a famous photograph of you as a little boy sitting on Picasso's lap, who was one of your guests, obviously. Do you remember that moment?
I do remember it in a vestigial sort of way, because I'm very young then. And I remember him better from the times later when we went to visit him in his houses in the south of France. But on that moment, yeah, there is that lovely photograph of him and me. And I know quite a bit about what happened, because Lee wrote a short article for Vogue magazine that was published along with that picture.
And it explaining was, what?
Yes, sort of, but also explaining that I had bitten Picasso and he bit me right back.
Where did you bit him?
I bit him on the wrist.
Okay.
Yes, we were playing a game called bullfights. It was way before I understood how really obnoxious bullfighting is. And I was the bull, and I would have to put my horns on and run at Picasso. And then he would jump out of the way, and I would crash into the furniture or something like that. And so I thought after a while, this is not a good strategy. So I watched, and I waited, and I crept up, and I bit him.
And where did he bite you?
I think it was again on the wrist.
Okay.
Because it was winter.
That's
we were
fair.
Wearing a lot of clothes. And so, you know, he bit me back. And as aversion therapy, it works, because I've never bitten another artist since.
Right. So after your mother's death in 1977, you discovered 60,000 original negatives and 20,000 prints and contact sheets. And you discovered her war photography, because you never knew what she was doing during war days, right?
She never spoke about the war, except for, you know, a few trivial passing remarks.
Right.
I had no understanding that she'd been, say, at the Siege of San Marlo. I had no understanding that she'd been at the liberation of the death camps, or fought her way across Germany, or fought her way through Alsace in terrifying conditions. She just didn't mention that, and nor did my father, partly because he didn't know much anyway, she'd never told him anything, and also because there was a kind of conspiracy of silence. I think they wanted to protect me from it. And also, more importantly, I think it would have triggered her PTSD, her post-traumatic stress disorder, and she just did not want to go back there.
She didn't talk to anybody?
No, no. You think about it, her head was full of demons that were crashing around. Some people have said that she did speak about it kind of like in a passing sort of way, but never to me.
So you really learned to know her through studying her work then? Well, you said that you couldn't have asked about what she had seen.
Of course, and when they figure out how to email dead people, I have a list that's a very long one that I'm going to send to her of questions. And so, yeah, I was, of course, full of regret. But fortunately, at this point in time, key people of her life were still alive, like my father, like people like David Sherman and his colleagues, like John Phillips, the Cyborgian. They were all people who had known her, worked with her, been correspondents with her in Europe. And it was really important to be able to talk to them. And there were a lot of them. You know, there were about 7 or 8 really key people. And, of course, they sadly all died fairly quickly after that. But it was just so wonderful to have those eyewitnesses there. Sherman was particularly brilliant because he had this amazing memory. He could remember dates, times, places, faces, motives, who was doing what. And I could never have written The Lives of Lee Miller without him.
Right. Is this when you learned, yeah, obviously, about the famous photography in Hitler's bathtub as well? Did Sherman tell you about it?
Sherman told me a lot about the Hitler's bathtub photograph because he took it. He was there. And then he hops in after she gets out.
Yeah.
So it's his boots on the mat. It's his clothes on top of her, on hers on the chair. And what we notice then is that Lee has tilted the camera up to include the shower head because that morning they'd been at Dachau where shower baths were in fact gas chambers. And so here is Sherman, who's Jewish, sitting underneath the showerhead in Hitler's bath. Now, that's a metaphor that can go a long way.
Wow.
Very powerful metaphor.
Is that your favorite photograph that she took?
The one that I keep coming back to that is really important to me is one that's full of metaphor and enigma, and it's called Portrait of Space. It's a view through a little rectangular window which was in a house in the western desert of Egypt. It was covered by a fly screen, but there's a big hole in the fly screen, which kind of invites you to want to disappear down the road that you can see heading off into the distance. And in the sky, there is a cloud that looks like a bird, but it can be a cloud or a bird, according to what you want. And then there's a frame. It's a little portrait-style frame. It used to be the hatch that you put your hand through to open and shut the storm shutters on the outside. But that's gone now. The flap has disappeared. But you still have the frame hanging there, framing space, a portrait of space. And that space is her gift to you to populate with your own dreams and your own imaginings.
That sounds amazing. What did Kate Winslet ask you when she prepared for the role of your mother?
She asked to come to the archive and see as much of the material as she could. And that's what she did. And we lost count of the number of days she spent with us because it was just so easy. She's this lovely, modest, friendly person, kind of like devoid of any ego. And she'd just come and sit and we'd give her stuff to read. And so she got a lot out of Lee's letters to Audrey and Audrey's letters to Lee. She got a lot out of the other letters to people like Sherman, to other friends, to Lee's parents and so on. It was the letters and the little appointment diaries and things that really, I think, did it for her. But then she would ask to see the maps or want to see a whole sequence of photographs or whatever. And I didn't really understand the process, but I knew that what she was doing was trying to absorb Lee's personality, not from what I'd told her so much, but mainly from what she found in the work. And I think this was a really brilliant way of going about it. And I think the way she interpreted the eye behind the work was very, very accurate. So she just kept going and kept going. And then, of course, we had the screenplay written by Marion Hume. And that was, again, a big collaboration between Kate and Marion and me. And then Liz Hannah came along and refined it. And it was just something that Kate worked on every inch of the way.
So you're an artist as well. You wrote quite a few books. And you're a curator and you're taking care of the museum that takes care of the legacy of your parents. Apart from your own museum, what's your favorite museum in the world?
Oh, gosh, I like different museums for different reasons. But the most important museum to me in the whole world, anywhere, is a museum which is next to the Martin Gropius Bau here in Berlin, and it's called the Topography of Terror. And you go in that and you see exactly, step by step, how the Nazis gained power by the manipulation of the media in the 30s. It is the most brilliantly done museum. I haven't been back there this visit. I really want to see if I can get there. It is beautifully done. It is salutary. Every country in the world should be able to see that museum because it shows how misled we are by our leaders at times. And it's a big lesson. And it's a wonderful museum. And I congratulate you people here for having created that.
So last question. We ask this question every guest in this podcast, so I'm asking to you as well. If I gave you a piece of art, any piece of art, in fact, which one would you choose?
You mean one that is not already in my collection?
Right. That you would like to have.
I would like to have back in my family a painting called The Woman Weeping. It used to belong to my father. It's by Pablo Picasso. It's now in the Tate Gallery. And it is one of the greatest anti-war paintings ever made because it's a picture of the agonized face of a woman who has just been in the bombing of Guernica in just before the, 1936. And we can see the horror in her face. We can see the reflection of the airplanes in her eyes. We can just see the agony that she's suffering, watching her town being destroyed, her family, her children being killed. And that painting I grew up with. And when I saw it as a child, it always bothered me. And I said to my mum, "Why is the lady crying?" And my mother said, "She lived in a town called Guernica in Spain. And one day, without any warning on market day, airplanes came over and dropped bombs and killed lots and lots of people and set fire to the whole place. Maybe they even killed her little boy." Well, I guess I was about 8 at the time. It made me very, very worried when an airplane came over, I can tell you, for a long time. But I've never forgotten that painting. It was sold to the Tate Gallery. And it's good that it's there because it's being viewed by thousands of people
right.
who I hope understand the story. But at the same time, there's something about her that I would love to have back in my life personally.
Anthony, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much and all the best for the really remarkable movie.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Das war Folge 96 von Die Sucht zu sehen. Wir danken fürs Zuhören, freuen uns schon wieder auf unsere nächsten Gäste und natürlich auf Sie. In 2 Wochen neu auf griesebach.com und überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.